Lorsque vous aurez repris la route de Paris, à la fin de vos vacances.
Hi, Sarah. Yeah, it's been quite an eventful summer here in France.
True.
We kicked off with parliamentary elections that left no one party with an outright majority. So we've got a hung parliament.
Yeah, that means no prime minister was appointed right away. And President Macron said he'd put off that decision even longer until after the Olympics, which dragged out the process, creating political gridlock, lots of infighting.
Yeah, we've had 2 months with a caretaker government now, and we've only just got a prime minister, the conservative elder statesman, Michel Barnier. So he was Macron's pick, and he has the near impossible task of forming a unity government.
Right, not easy, pretty tricky. Using the Olympics as an excuse for keeping the current government in place infuriated much of the opposition. There was talk of an administrative coup d'etat, lots of words being thrown around. The far left, even the far right.
Yeah.
But it's true that many people's minds were focused on the games this summer, especially those of us who stayed in Paris.
Yeah, like you. The Olympics were deemed a huge success in the end, partly because there had been so much talk about how they wouldn't be a success. There was the risk of terror attacks. There was going to be massive transport strikes, a gridlocked capital.
Yeah, and it was really not the case. Not only were there no major incidents, the French got totally into it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never seen this many French flags flying around or drawn on people's faces.
Yeah.
It's like as if they've been waiting for the opportunity to enjoy themselves publicly, fly the flag, be friendly to foreigners. Mm-hmm. Even the police got cheered. And so that's the Paralympic anthem, and the Paralympics came after the Olympics. They were also deemed a big success.
Yeah, Parisians who were out of town for the Olympics at the beginning of the summer were really glad to get in finally on the festivities with round two, as it were.
Yeah, and there was hope that these Paralympics would have an impact on disability issues more broadly in France. I mean, all of the games were broadcast in full on national television because it's still very difficult to live disabled in France, getting to school, holding a job, all these things, and sport, you know, in Paris, it already requires monumental effort to get around on a wheelchair. And there are only 40 sports clubs that offer handy sport or adapted sport or inclusive sport. I met a growing club that's trying to bring disabled and non-disabled people together through sport. This is the sound of inclusive volleyball. It's a game played low to the ground with a yoga ball rolled under the net. It's the brainchild of Jérôme Rousseau, who founded the Novo Sports Club in 2020 to get disabled and non-disabled people to play sports together. The rules are still being defined.
Sometimes one person has got one touch on the ball or two, but it depends, you know, the physical problems.
He built on a game that was being played by some disabled people in France already.
At the beginning, it was only for persons with electric wheelchair and manual chair. And I say, okay, it's okay, but if you haven't got disability, you can't play. And we create this sport for that person not disability doesn't take a wheelchair, but play with their mobility, and that's more important. Sports and inclusion definition is say, okay, on the same area, we have different persons with mental disability and physical disability, and we can play.
Jérôme is quadriplegic. He can't use his arms and legs. He can move a couple of fingers, which he uses to move around his electric wheelchair. He was born like this, but he also loves sport.
I'm a sports fan to the PhD. I'm a fan about it, and I have watched the Olympic and Paralympic Games, and I'm happy for France because we have win on the sexy foot.
But finding sports he could play himself has never been easy. Today, at the age of 27, he plays electric wheelchair football. He attaches bumpers to his chair to strike the ball. And he runs this club that includes people with all kinds of disabilities, in wheelchairs and not, as well as non-disabled people.
Alors, du coup là, on va jouer au volet inclusif. L'objectif, c'est que la balle passe en dessous du filet.
Jérôme explains the rules of inclusive volleyball to a group of his club members and visiting players from Berlin. A coach warms up the group, showing the non-disabled players how to sit down on the ground before they hit the ball. Elliot plays volleyball with the club, as well as baskin, inclusive basketball, which is a more established sport. It was invented in Italy. Elliot says he prefers baskin because he can play standing up.
Il faut que je joue assis au sol et c'est très compliqué et on a des problèmes de respiration inversée.
Because he is able-bodied, in inclusive volleyball, he has to sit when he hits the ball, which he says is difficult for him because he has breathing problems. He's 22, on the autism spectrum, with a genetic disorder that's left him with developmental disabilities and mostly blind.
Mon fils, qui n'a pas d'autonomie pour se déplacer dans Paris seul.
That's Elliot's father, Philippe, who says his son can't get around on his own and was at home doing pretty much nothing until a year ago when he met Jérôme at an event. He was brought into the club as an intern and given a job to promote it. Philippe says it's given his son purpose. Elliot had trouble getting through school. Sport became his life. He's played tennis since he was 12, though it took a while to find a club that would accept him.
Certains refus d'intégrer un club de sport classique parce qu'il ne parlait pas beaucoup.
Some regular clubs refused to take him. He didn't talk much. His symptoms were worse than they are now. So there was categorical refusal to take him on. They would say they can't manage him. It's too complicated. He has outbursts. I appreciate that people need to be trained to manage this, but there's also the fact that if they're willing, then they can make something happen. It's just about wanting to do it.
When Elliot was 12, they finally connected with the president of the tennis club that was willing to work with Elliot and adapt to his visual limitations, among other things. By taking an inclusive approach to sport, NovoSport is innovative. In Paris, where the para or handy sport options are already quite limited, it's often either a club that has a couple of disabled members or a club of just disabled players and no one mixes. Paul Quesada, the project manager of NovoSport, says inclusivity allows people to mix.
We have lots of examples with children with disability that now can play with their parents that have no disability, and parents with disability can play with their children. If you have a friend that has a disability, you can play with him. So these kind of sports allows people to play together, and they can also be competitive because the rules are made.
The fact that it is structured means that disabled people don't feel as much of a disadvantage playing with people who are not disabled. Paul, who is not disabled, does a lot of outreach, mostly to convince disabled people that it's okay to play with non-disabled players.
Most of the people with disability want to play with people that have the same disability, but they are scared to play with people with no disability because they would say, but the player that has no disability will have an advantage. But when we explain the rules, they understand that they can play and on an equal moment.
So, Sarah, has the club been impacted in any way by the recent Paralympics?
Actually, it has. So it's a 50-member club right now. They're aged 14 to 60, just over half of whom are disabled. And they said that already, with the Paralympics, it just ended a week ago, they're already seeing a boost in interest. People are calling, maybe wanting to get involved. I mean, they definitely also had some media coverage with the Paralympics. But this idea of, you know, inclusive sport, handy sport is definitely in the air. They're hoping to capitalize on this and grow their membership.
So it does sound like a bit of a success story.
Absolutely. However, let's put this into perspective. This is one of 40 sports clubs open to disabled people in Paris. Paris is a city of 2.2 million people with at least 160,000 disabled people.
Right.
So the offer isn't very big. And then a huge challenge just remains basic accessibility. People just getting to the gym, for example, the metros are not wheelchair accessible, that kind of thing. And then the gyms themselves aren't always accessible. So a very good example is when I went to go see this inclusive volleyball session, this was in a sports complex that was supposedly accessible, But even getting in was a chore. The front entrance had bars that were there blocking bikes and scooters from getting into the courtyard. Great, except that Jérôme's wheelchair couldn't fit through. Mm. So those in wheelchairs had to go to the far end of the complex, go in through this locked gate. We had to find the key and then go all the way around two football fields in order to finally access the gym.
That's just incredible.
Yeah, yeah. I was shocked. Yeah. I really was. Jérôme wasn't fazed. For him, this is daily life, and that's what he's fighting against to get things done.
So the issue of inclusion in sport goes back further than you might think, Sarah. A century ago, in 1924, Paris organized the first International Silent Games for deaf athletes.
So in 1924, this was also when Paris hosted the Olympic Games.
Yeah, exactly. And several decades before the Paralympics were created. Now, the Silent Games were the first sports events of their kind, specifically for athletes with a disability. Jess Phelan is here and can tell us more about this. Hi, Jess.
Hi, Alison. Hi, Sarah. Yeah, so the first Silent Games took place from the 10th to the 17th of August 1924. So it was just 2 weeks after the Paris Olympics. And in our last episode before the summer, we talked about how those games were kind of a turning point for the modern Olympics. Well, the Silent Games were also a landmark, but they're a lot less well remembered today. And the National Institute for Young Deaf People here in Paris is currently hosting an exhibition that tells the story of the first Silent Games. Its curator, the sports historian Didier Séguillon, explains how they came about.
L'idée, c'était donc de montrer à la population qu'ils étaient capables, capables sans adaptation, aucune.
The idea was to show people that they were capable, capable without any special adaptation. Deaf people wanted to do the same activities, exactly the same activities, in the same conditions and with the same rules as hearing people, to show just how normal they were, how to use sport, to say, we don't have a handicap.
So there was a big political element, he says, because this was a time when deaf people were considered to be inferior, both physically and intellectually. And the vast majority of deaf children didn't go to school. And if they did, they weren't taught in sign language because the thinking was that they should try to use oral language, speaking out loud. And that put them at a huge disadvantage, often for the rest of their lives. But deaf people were starting to push back and say, we can study, we can work, we can do sport, we just need the opportunity. And one of the leading voices in that movement for deaf rights was a guy called Eugène Ruben Alquet. He was from the south of France, from a working class background, and in his day job, he worked as a mechanic.
Il y a un très bon cycliste, enfin, au départ, il est footballeur.
He was a very good cyclist. He actually started out as a footballer for Nîmes. Then he moved to Paris and took up cycling and middle distance running. So he was a dedicated sportsman.
And he was deaf?
Yes, he lost his hearing when he was about 9 years old. And that's important because it meant that he knew both oral French and sign language. And that's part of what made him a great ambassador for deaf people.
C'est quelqu'un qui est extrêmement performant.
He was extremely good at both speaking and writing French. He used his speaking skills to approach politicians and he knew how to do it. He knocked on doors. He wasn't the type to back away from a challenge. Let's say he wasn't shy.
Ruben Alquet campaigned for all kinds of deaf rights, but sport was really his true passion. And he was involved in setting up sports clubs for deaf people. And when the Olympics came to Paris in 1924, he saw an opportunity. He got permission to use some of the Olympic venues. He invited people from other countries and he helped organize the first International Silent Games.
So how big of an event was this?
Well, they had all the same formalities as the Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. There was a big parade by the different delegations. They raised all the flags. They did the Olympic oath, but they used sign language for mm-hmm. that.
It makes sense.
And around 145 athletes took part from 9 different countries, all of them European, and almost all men, although there was one woman swimmer from the Netherlands. And over the week, they competed in 7 different disciplines: athletics, swimming, cycling, shooting, football, diving, and tennis. And as Séguillon said, they followed exactly the same rules as hearing athletes. It was all part of proving that they were equal to them.
And did that work?
Well, one French sports paper said the athletes are, quote, certainly not of the highest international standard, but that some of them could maybe be regional champions. Mm. And to be honest, Séguillon agrees. The athletes who took part in those first games weren't necessarily the very best of the best. It was really expensive to get to Paris. They had to pay their own way. But more than anything, he says, the event got all these deaf people from different countries together and gave them a chance to organise. So alongside the sports events, they also held the founding meeting of the International Committee of Sports for the Deaf, which still exists today. And they've continued to organise the games ever since, although they're now known as the Deaflympics.
So this is separate from the Olympics or even the Paralympics.
That's right. So being deaf on its own doesn't qualify you to compete in the Paralympics, nor does it stop you competing in the Olympics, but you'd obviously be at a disadvantage if you can't hear a starting pistol or a referee's whistle, for example. And at the Deaflympics, they use visual signals instead as much as possible, so like a flag or a flash, and the officials speak sign language. And apart from during World War II, these games have taken place pretty much every 4 years since 1924. But because they're not part of the bigger Olympic and Paralympic movement, they obviously get a lot less attention and especially less funding.
Money is so important, isn't there? Is there any talk then about creating a category for deaf athletes inside the Paralympics?
Yeah, it's a big topic of debate. And according to Séguillon, there's kind of a generational divide between younger deaf athletes who want to compete at the highest level, have access to the best facilities, the most prestigious events, the biggest rewards. And then there's the original vision of the Silent Games, which was an event organised by deaf people for deaf people. And the founding father, Ruben Alquet, said that the games would help create a single global deaf nation, not set countries against each other trying to just win the most medals. And that's something that Didier Séguillon thinks we could still learn from today.
Thanks there to Jess Phelan.
So the Olympics and Paralympics brought the French together, Sarah.
Yeah, Tony Estanguet, the former Olympic canoe champion and the chief organizer of the Paris Games, said the Paralympics had made us better people.
Alas, the same cannot be said of French politicians, unless they went to see the Paralympics. I don't know about that, because they've been showing just how self-seeking and certainly uncompromising they can be. As we mentioned at the beginning of the show, there's been a curtain take a government now since the 7th of July, after the parliamentary elections gave no one party a working majority.
And then since then, they have been fighting like cats and dogs.
Yeah, it hasn't helped that President Macron named a prime minister from the conservative right. That infuriated the left-wing NFP alliance that won the most votes in the elections. The prime minister, Michel Barnier, has to form this unity government, but that means getting the hard left, the far right, and the president's centre-right bloc to, well, sit down and agree on some common ground.
And it's really hard to imagine what that common ground might be.
Yeah, it's a tough one, and it will involve inevitably some compromises. But in France, that notion is very often associated with giving in.
Right.
So I talked to Laure Gillot-Assayag about all of this. She's a researcher in political science and philosophy, and she's been writing about the late 20th century French philosopher Paul Ricoeur. He famously wrote about the importance of compromise in a democracy. And she says that message is more relevant now than it's ever been.
Paradoxically, because France is so politically divided, I would say that a culture of compromise is more necessary than ever. Right now, there are 11 different political groups in the National Assembly, which is a record, and three main political forces, the far right, Ensemble, and the New Popular Front, that is a broad left-wing electoral alliance. And when there is no clear majority, you simply cannot govern without compromise, without finding common ground.
Is it true to say, Law, that France doesn't have a very strong culture of compromise, contrary to some of its European neighbours?
I think it's difficult to say that France lacks a culture of compromise in absolute terms, as it risks kind of oversimplifying a nation's political characters. However, it is true that the French political landscape has often been shaped over the centuries by conflict. Of course, we can think of the French Revolution, but also more recent events like the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vest protest, the social movements, strikes in general. And for that reason, France is often seen as a country where social and political tensions are resolved through direct action rather than negotiation.
To what degree does the Fifth Republic itself not encourage this culture of compromise?
If we look at French political institutions, of course, one of the reasons of lack of compromise is the institutional framework of the Fifth Republic. The fact that until recently we had something called the majoritarian fact, where the government could largely ignore minority opinions due to its strong majority. That is a bit similar to the winner-takes-all system in the US. And another reason for this resistance to compromise might be the strong presidential system. The Fifth Republic, we have to remember that, was designed by Charles de Gaulle, and de Gaulle wanted to put an end to the regime of parties of the Fourth Republic because he saw that as a factor of instability due to constant shifting alliances. So it was aimed to make the National Assembly an extension of the president's will. I think the present difficulty to attain a compromise is the competition between the parliamentary logic on the one hand and the presidential logic. And these are two conflicting logics that lead to a confrontation, that it also explains why it has taken so long to appoint a prime minister in France.
So the message that came out of the legislative elections seems to be, we don't want any one of those groupings to have total control. We do want more of a coalition, but the politicians themselves don't seem to be capable of compromise.
Actually, what we're seeing, what we are witnessing, rather than a lack of culture of compromise, is the real obstacles to make it work. And opposition parties such as the France Insoumise,
the hard left, France Unbowed,
but also the National Rally, they have a fundamental opposition to the government's agenda. And this reflects a broader tendency towards radical dissent rather than compromise. There is a tendency to focus on divisions on many issues within the left itself. The Socialists and the France Insoumise, for instance, they have disagreements on many topics, from Ukraine to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, nuclear energy. So this means that the problem of compromise relates also to a problem of individuals. It's not only the idea that we can find a compromise together, it's also who is making a compromise, who is willing to take the lead on that common agreement. And for instance, the leader of France Insoumise, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, said that he wanted to apply his program, all of its program, but they opposed a potential socialist government. And so they left the role of leader and oversight to the far-right party, the National Rally. So I think there is also this opposition party's culture that plays a role in this resistance to compromise in France.
You're currently researching the French philosopher Paul Ricoeur, and one of the things he was really big on was this notion of compromise in a democracy and how important that is. And he did not see compromise as being a sign of weakness.
Yes, absolutely. Paul Ricoeur really offers a very strong and original take on compromise. He says that for an ethics of compromise, it's important to maintain a balance between the authority, what he calls the vertical axis of authority, which is democratic representation, and horizontal axis, which is the living together. And he said that politics is this paradox between the living together and the democratic authority that can never be basically resolved. Because he views politics as a constant compromise, he says that if there is one of the axes taking power, taking over the other axis, then we fall into violence, into authoritarianism. And that's why it means in simple terms that democracy cannot be only about participation, but it cannot also be summed up by a vertical decision-making process. Authority needs to be recognized, it needs to be authored by the citizens.
It's kind of ironic that Paul Ricoeur is often cited as being a major influence on President Emmanuel Macron. And yet, the way things are going at the moment, the president does not seem to have embraced this notion of compromise, you know, even calling these parliamentary elections in June without really consulting either his prime minister or members of the cabinet or the head of the National Assembly.
President Macron is not seen as the president who easily compromises, and he's been accused of authoritarianism. And for instance, the appointment of the prime minister, Michel Barnier, made the French left furious. They see this appointment as a denial of democracy, but also a denial of compromise, because President Macron has the final say. The prime minister is appointed by the president, but usually it comes from a political party belonging to the majority in the National Assembly. And it's the New Popular Front that won the most seats at the July election. So there is this rejection of Macron from the left mostly, but also because they see Macron, the President Macron, as someone lacking this spirit of compromise.
If there can be a working and effective government, then perhaps something has to change and there has to be more embracing of compromise. Can you see any signs that could happen or that will happen?
The positive note that I can see now is that many political parties and the general public in France are beginning to realize that compromise is crucial for democracy. And what is also encouraging is that this call for compromise isn't confined to just one party or ideology. It's really a broader movement. Bernard Cazeneuve from the Socialist Party, but also the Republicans, even some members from La France Insoumise are advocating for compromise. And I think this shows that there is a new desire of collaboration, of finding common ground. It's still quite new, but it's a significant development. There are concrete measures we can think of to promote an ethics of compromise, broadly speaking, enhancing the role of civil society. But also, I think there is a way to focus more on educational strategies for political representatives, some sort of educational training for elected officials. That sounds a little bit bold, but you know, the Council of Europe, European institutions in general, they all stressed the importance of lifelong learning for adults as a way to consolidate democracy. And I think parliamentarians are also citizens after all, and we need to make sure that they also understand the rules of the political games, the duties, the rights as democratic actors in the political system. And we need to make sure that they appreciate how this ethics of compromise is also central to our collective living and working together.
It's an interesting idea of all those politicians being encouraged to go back to school and train on how to value each other's opinions.
Yeah, can you just imagine this big group of cross-party MPs coming out of the National Assembly one day saying, hey, we've agreed to compromise. Wouldn't that just be a turn up for the books?
For sure.
So that's the end of the show. Spotlight on France is a production of Radio France International, and this episode was mixed by Cécile Pompiani.
If you want to send us a message, we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr. You can also find us on Instagram, Spotlight on France.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks' time on Thursday, September the 26th. Bye-bye, Sarah.
Bye, Alison.